Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might know me as one of the co-authors to Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, or the upcoming Real Life Paleo books. But what you'll find out on this show is that I really like to talk about tangents and soapboxes, and definitely about lifting heavy things.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm the author of two books, The Paleo Approach and the upcoming companion guide, The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm a huge nutrient density geek, and I just can't help talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. Lady on the other side of a couple of big ponds.
I love how we just say hello and pretend that we haven't just been talking for 10 minutes.
Well, we could have started the show regularly if you weren't so far away with a terrible internet connection.
That's true. I blame space and how the signal has to travel to it and back.
Indeed.
So, how have you been? How's your week?
It's all right.
I feel like it's been a really, really long time since we last talked. Like, at least 3 months. I have fit 3 months worth of stuff into the last week.
Yeah. I didn't do a lot of fun stuff over the course of the week. Although this weekend I had fun. So my grandfather's funeral was Friday, and I spoke at it, which is always unnerving. Mm-hmm. But it's nice to be able to contribute to his memories. And then Saturday we went to my company's work summer picnic, and that was at a park, and the boys had a really great time. We found a box turtle hiding in the mulch in the playground. Of course, my paleo kids with their super laser vision, Wesley of all people, spots this turtle and starts torturing it. Fortunately, it was a box turtle and not a snapping turtle.
That would have been a lesson learned really quickly.
Yeah. So, you know, we got some learning time with she was a Mrs. Turtle, and we looked up on the internet how to tell the difference. And
I was just going to say, I don't know how to tell the difference between a Mr. and a Mrs. Turtle.
We figured it out. The Google is a wonderful place. And then we put it back on the edge of the woods because we felt worried for the turtle on the playground, with many active children running around in the mulch where he blended in.
Yeah.
And then we hung out. Finn and I and Wesley went to the pool while Cole and Matt went to the grocery store to buy what we thought was all the food for the final cover of Real Life Paleo, which we shot on Sunday. Turns out we actually went to the grocery store 4 additional times on Sunday itself because we just kept making different dishes, trying to make it work. And thanks to my buddies, Russ at The Domestic Man, Brent and Heather from Virginia's for Hunter Gatherers, our wonderful paleo sitter, Sam, who is also a aspiring chef and food blogger, and Amy, of course, and Matt, my lovely husband. We finally have a final cover for Real Life Paleo. Well, we have the picture for it, and I have the cover mocked out, so it just needs to go to designers who are, I don't know, like busy working on books that are actually going to print instead of books that print in November.
They may or may not be working on my book.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, exactly. So, I worked with Arish on Sunday in between his ravenous work with you, and
he actually got off the phone with me though at one point in order to call you. He was like, oh, I just got Stacy's cover back. I got to call Stacy. Like, oh, you totally have to call Stacy. We're done. It's fine. We'd been on the phone for like an hour and a half at that point. Like, it was time to take a break. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I got to see your cover.
Yeah. So everybody, it's the mock-ups on Instagram. If people want to go check it out, I'm sure we can put a link in the show notes. But hopefully the actual final cover that like a designer will do and not just me pretending with Adobe, will be up probably in about 2 weeks on Amazon, because it'll probably take about a week to get a designer to do it, and then it takes a week for Amazon to load it. So we will definitely be sharing and broadcasting and blogging more about the book as we get kind of design mock-ups and information done. But we tried really hard for the new cover to showcase what the special things are about the book in a way that wasn't so busy. We couldn't figure out how to do that with the first cover because we were just piecing together a bunch of the photos from the book and trying to tell a story. But when you have time to plan out after you've written all the recipes and all that kind of stuff, and you say, okay, what story am I trying to tell and how do I want to portray it? I feel like we were able to capture that. What we think is really special about our book is not only is it 175 recipes that you would typically find in a cookbook, but we've also shot a lot of the recipes together in full meal spreads to show people how to put meals together. There's a lunch, there's a breakfast, lunch, and dinner for each phase. And we've also incorporated our philosophy of a three-phased approach to paleo and put in a lot more material for that in the book. So the cover represents it, the foods as a full meal. It's very approachable meal. It's not like overly complex. And
and it made me want to hop a plane to come to your house to eat the leftovers.
Yeah.
I was like, there's a lot of that food over their house right now. I wonder how many hours it would take me to get there.
Oh my gosh, there's so much food. Because what ended up on the cover, we made like three meals before that was final. And when we sent Arish what we thought was the final at 3:30, and he gave us, Arish is our publisher, and he gave us good feedback, but it wasn't what we wanted to hear. We were a little perturbed, especially because after 3:30, like, even though the sun's still out, the sun isn't as bright. So it's much more difficult to do. We do natural light photography. So it was quite a mad dash to the finish to try to revise the foods that were on there. We had kale chips on there as the vegetable, and they just didn't, they were too dark.
That's what they were.
Yeah, see, exactly.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out, I was like, is it braised greens? Like, yeah. It was clearly, I kind of thought it was kale, but I couldn't tell it was a chip.
Yeah. And our love of yuca fries is evidently not as widespread loved as everybody's.
And I knew it was yuca.
Yeah, but we're like among the minority. And so it also was very similar color to the chicken fingers. So we went with something with a different tone. We went with sweet potato chips instead of yuca fries. And Russ was funny because Russ was here and Russ was like, okay, I approve. This still has a starch. So yeah, it's done. The cover has chicken fingers and sweet potato chips and citrus broccoli, which are all recipes in the book, obviously, and our fruit-sweetened chocolate chip cookies. Obviously, the chocolate chips aren't fruit-sweetened, but you can buy whatever kind of chocolate you want. That recipe is insanely good, and super happy about how it all turned out. And then we've represented the phases with the foods, so their swap, remove, and heal are all represented. Oh, we also have butternut squash soup with bacon, which is butternut bisque with bacon is one of our very popular recipes on the site. So we're happy that recipe made it into the book and onto the cover. So
I'm sort of done the Paleo Approach cookbook.
Yay!
It's like the weirdest being done, not done. So the cookbook got uploaded to the printer last night. So that sounds like the finish line, but it's not actually the finish line because now we wait for proofs to come back, and then the proofs have to be, so the printer prints, I mean, really it's going to end up being like a quarter or a half of the book, and then overnights those pages to Arish, the aforementioned publisher, who then, I mean, he's looking for, you know, how clear things are, the colors. I mean, what he's looking for is really, really technical. But then we have, after he gets those proofs, basically 24 hours in order to make any adjustments. So, for example, you know, photograph will print and the colors won't quite be the true colors. So he needs to adjust the colors in order to make it so that when it prints, it looks like that actual food. So there's sort of time to do those adjustments. And then what's happening is while we, you know, have these 3 days before we upload this final version with any adjustments made, we also get to continue making revisions. And so the goal was to have like the book be perfect when we uploaded it to the printer last night. And so I asked for like, when you're done uploading, cause I, talked with Eric as he was starting the upload before I went to bed, you know, can you please, drop it into Dropbox for me and share it with me so I can, I'm going to have a final one more read through of this, you know, final book. And I opened it up this morning and I said, oh, looks like we forgot to design the table of contents. Oops. So like, I don't know how.
That's a thing that you should do.
Right. Exactly. And so then we ended up having like a meeting today of, what's not done. I said, well, the table of contents, and it turns out we're still tweaking the index and then I still get to have this final read through and make sure, that we've caught all the little typos and, it's just amazing the level of detail that goes into creating a book. And I don't want someone who's reading the book to think of it, right? If they're thinking about all the detail that goes into it, that means that something's not right. And they're thinking about it because a mistake jumped out of the page at them. And ideally that should never happen. Although, it's impossible to catch 100% of everything. But yeah, so it's done, except it's not really done until Thursday. So I'm in this, like, I want to celebrate, but I can't actually because there's so much work to do. It's beautiful. It looks really good. I lost the mini recipe battle. The book has 207 full recipes. And then one of the things that I did, I really approached this book in large part as a way to get people more comfortable in the kitchen and get people more comfortable with, flavors that go well together and get them experimenting. And it was sort of largely inspired by Julia Child's The Way to Cook, which was a book that I really learned how to cook from. And what she has is she has these master recipes and then she gives you variations. And so she gives you just enough information that after you've cooked the master recipe, you can figure out what to do to make this variation. And so I built in a lot of variations into the book. And one of the things that ended up happening was I ended up including what I was thinking of as mini recipes. So for example, I have a roast beef recipe and then I have at the bottom, it's a mini recipe. It's just, here's how you make horseradish sauce. And it's not a recipe on its own. It's, there's no photograph for it, but there's, information how to make homemade horseradish sauce. And so I wanted, there's actually 100 of these little tiny, change this and this and this, and you have this completely different dish, or, use this sauce and add it to this. And then you have this other thing. And so I wanted to, let's say that there's 100 mini recipes. And nobody liked the term mini recipes. Nobody liked the term bonus recipes. We couldn't agree on what to call them. So we ended up just not calling them anything and not actually mentioning them. I'm like, oh, okay. That was a lot of work to put all those in there. I guess it's just like an extra bonus for the people who buy the book that there's not only 207 recipes, but there's like all these variations, including all of these like tangents of how to make something that will go with this dish or how to turn this dish into something completely different. So I lost that battle. I went with the copy editor and the publisher ganged up against me. So,
well, they're still there. So.
They are still there and it's still going to be an amazing resource. One of the things we did add sort of last minute was tearaway guides. So I'm pretty excited about that. And it does. It's really come together really beautifully. And I'm really looking forward to Thursday when it's really, 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 really over. I think it's going to be really anticlimactic, though. So I've been working on a book full-time for 21 months. So if you can imagine how, I think most authors I mean, certainly some books do take that amount of time, and there have been many books published in sort of paleo topic that have been sort of labors of love that have taken that long. But most authors get breaks, and they're not spending 21 months going full speed working on books. So I'm not quite sure what to expect when it's over. I don't think I'll be bored because my inbox is ridiculous, and I think it'll take me 3 weeks just to catch up on that. But it's done, sort of done, sort of done. It's done, sort of.
Well, congrats.
There was one thing I wanted to mention before we get into like a real show. We're actually everyone doing a real show again. Is that I am doing book signings. They're joint signings with Mickey Trescott of Autoimmune Paleo and Russ Crandall of The Domestic Man, two of my favorite bloggers. And we're doing a book signing at Book Warehouse on East Broadway in Vancouver on July 11th. And we're doing a book signing at Elliott Bay Books in Seattle on July 12th. And I just wanted to sort of let people know there's like times and exact addresses and links to RSVP on my site at thepaleomom.com/events. And one of the things that we found out just this week is that Elliott Bay Books in Seattle, they don't want to stock very many copies of The Ancestral Table or The Paleo Approach. So if anybody who listens to the podcast is planning on coming out to the book signings and meeting us, if you were planning on buying a copy of either Russ's book or my book at the signing, the best option is to go online and pre-order the book from Elliott Bay Books. And there's, if you follow the links to RSVP, there's links to pre-order the book as well. Or to come with a copy of your book that you bought from somewhere else. And that doesn't really support Elliott Bay Books for me to say that. But they may, if they see a lot of pre-orders, they may then up the number of copies that they're willing to stock. But I guess they've decided that they're not really expecting the turnout that our current RSVP list would indicate we will have. I'm trying to find the most polite way to say this. So please come out and show them that they're wrong and pre-order a book so that they see that they should order more copies. That's all I got.
All right. Well, and for those of you who have already purchased either at a different place or online and you're not local, you're awesome and we heart you. We're sorry that we keep talking about our books, but we said it before, and people said that they really were thankful that we said it, so I'll say it again. Despite the glamorous life that you think Sarah and I have, and that we somehow have magical money coming in from your love and support, that is not necessarily the case. And the way that Sarah makes a living and that I am going to put my children through college and the way that we're able to justify the amount of energy and time that we take away from our family and our friends and our spouses and generally our lives is by trying to compensate ourselves monetarily for the work that we do. And it's not because we don't do this because we want to help people. It's just that like you, if you spent a lot of time working on something, you would like to be compensated for it, I'm sure. So we actually don't make a ton of money off of the books that we write. A lot of people would probably be surprised to know the percentage of the sales price of a book that actually goes into the author's pocket. But every single book that's purchased, we appreciate and thank you. And it does help make our lives easier. It helps us, have team members that support our blogging efforts, which helps us have better work-life balance. And without your financial support with, you know, visiting our blogs and clicking the links to our affiliates and our sidebars and buying our books and purchasing ebooks through the sales and things that we promote that are all affiliates, we couldn't do this because we literally, Sarah and I each have a team of people that help us who are all wonderful and they deserve fair compensation as well. So we really thank you for your patience and support in our endeavors. And these are our babies. We love them. And we hope that you do too. And we're excited to share them with you. And we hope that you will enjoy them and support us in our endeavors. And to that end, we also got an extremely generous donation this week from, I guess I'll say anonymous, a gentleman, yeah. Nonetheless,
one of our six male listeners,
more than six, but yes. And so it was so shockingly, awesome. And Sarah and I, can't thank you enough. It's actually, supports at least a few months, if not half a year, of kind of hosting and Monica's efforts on the show notes and that sort of stuff. So it was a fantastic surprise, and we're really grateful for that generous gift donation, and also for everyone's support of the podcast. Every time you review us in iTunes, every time you click an affiliate link in the show notes, anytime you do any of that, it really genuinely does make a difference and help us out. So thank you.
I second that.
Awesome. So while I'm on a tangent, let me just tell you that I'm super excited about the show that we're going to do, because I am totally the bone broth lady, and we're going to do the Bone Broth Show.
Did you just make a tangent, like, bring us back on track to an actual show?
This is the only talent that I have on this podcast.
Let's keep it moving, folks, is pretty much the description of the talent. Yeah, so I actually, it's interesting because there's been a surprisingly large number of questions piling up on our queue about bone broth, and we got sort of a new one this week, and I was reading it, and I'm like, no, how many questions are there on bone broth? And there was actually like too many to fit into an episode. We're actually going to have a question heavy episode today. We'll try and keep it moving so it doesn't run too long, but it was really, really surprising. So I tried to pick the ones that sort of covered all of the bases, and hopefully the other people who ask bone broth questions will still hear the answer to their question, like within the questions that I picked out of the queue. But, people love bone broth. We love bone broth. We're really passionate about how important bone broth is in the diet. And there's a lot of questions about why, how, when, where, who. So I thought, what better thing to do than to talk about one of our favorite things?
Yeah, I love broth.
And that's the end of the show, right?
Right, I love broth.
that's a take-home message.
I am the bone broth lady.
There is actually a hashtag soup with Stacey.
There's also a hashtag bone broth heals.
We got any other hashtags?
I got a lot of hashtags, but I think those are the only ones for soup. Breakfast soup. I think that's another one.
I like breakfast soup. I do have to ask you a question. Can you hear the fly buzzing around my head through the microphone?
Maybe that's what I think is static, but no.
It's a very, very annoying fly. If I totally lose my train of thought and can't talk using cohesive sentences, I blame the fly. All right. So on that note, cohesive sentences would be the perfect segue to an actual Science with Sarah for the first time in like 5 weeks or 6 weeks.
I'm super excited.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
Science! So, I haven't forgotten about Science with Sarah. It was just really, really hard.
You haven't forgotten science? That PhD didn't science. Just go out the window?
not only partially. It started to. But... I, it's, it generally takes me a lot of time to prepare for these segments, and so it hasn't been something that's been easy to do in the last month. But today, I thought it would be really a great idea, since we're going to talk about bone broth, to really answer the question of what is in bone broth that gets us all excited? Why is it that we are calling this a really nutrient-dense food? So when we talk about bone broth, I mean, one of the reasons why we like bone broth is because of the bone health nutrients in it. And actually, the nutrients that are important for bone health are the same nutrients that are important for connective tissue health and skin health, hair, nails, teeth. I mean, these are all basically made up of, you know, sort of slightly different variations or different ratios of the same things. And so there's a huge variety of nutrients that are important for bone health. And I think people get very sort of focused on, we understand calcium, we understand vitamin D. We talk a lot about vitamin A and vitamin K2 as being really, really important for bone health as well. But it's actually, there's actually a much longer list. So it also includes other minerals like phosphorus, chromium, silica, zinc, manganese, copper, potassium, boron, and strontium. There is some question about whether or not fluoride has a normal role in bone health and what the actual ideal amount of fluoride is, what happens when there's too much fluoride. But fluoride may be an important bone health mineral as well. And then with vitamins, it's much more complicated than A, D, and K2. There's also water-soluble vitamins that are really, really important for bone health, B6, folate, which also goes by B9, B12, and vitamin C. And as part of it is, you know, some of these are actual constituents of bones. They're actually the ingredients you need for healthy bones. And some of them are regulating the bone deposition process. So it's actually regulating the formation of bone. It's also really important to have essential fatty acids. And especially for people, you know, when I say essential fatty acids, that means both omega-3s and 6s. 6s are so easy to get from the diet. It really means that we're focusing on the long-chain omega-3s, DHA and EPA, because of how skewed most people, unless you're putting a lot of thought into your omega-3 to omega-6 dietary ratio, most of us are very heavily skewed towards omega-6s. And it's one of the sort of fundamental tenets of the paleo diet to start working towards finding better balance between omega-3 intake and omega-6 intake. And what I'll talk about again in a second is there's actually about 35% of bone is actually protein. So 65% of bone is the minerals and the structures, so the crystalline structures around the minerals. But then the what's gluing all that together is actually proteins, and it's actually collagen. So collagen is, a fairly simple protein. It's very, very rich in glycine, prolamine, and glutamic acid. And so all of these nutrients are critical to get in the diet in order to support bone health. And one of the reasons why bone broth is so great for bone health is because you're taking bones and you are dissolving the constituents of bones into liquid. So you're drinking the ingredients that bones are made out of. And so some of the things that you get from bone broth in particular are the minerals. So there's a lot of calcium, but there's also a lot of, you know, magnesium, manganese, phosphorus, these other potassium, these other really, really important structural components of bones. But you're also getting that collagen. And that one of the reasons why bone broth is so healthy for other connective tissue is because all connective tissue is based on collagen. I mean, it can be mixed up with other things, but collagen is the major component. So it's one of the reasons why, you know, also collagen supplements can be really, really helpful for bone health. But when you do a collagen supplement, you're not then getting all of the minerals. So it really comes down to the fact that bone broth is an incredibly nutrient-dense food. It's actually considered awful. Because bones are not an organ, they're actually considered one of these, like, they're not a muscle, so they're considered sort of the stuff that would be typically thrown away. and shouldn't be, because it is really one of the most nutrient-dense foods and nutrients that are missing when you overly focus on a diet that's sort of muscle meats and vegetables and fruit and nuts and seeds. So those are really, really essential nutrients to get for bone health, joint health, connective tissue health. Connective tissue is required anytime you're healing. So it's one of the reasons why broth is so important for healing, whether it's healing the gut or healing an injury, because connective tissue is the glue that holds all of our cells together. And you need to regenerate cells, but you also need to have the glue in between them. And so it is, this is why this nutrient density and these really, really important nutrients for basically every part of your body is why we are so passionate about bone broth. And it's why we go to such efforts to maximize the nutrients that we extract from the bones in our broth. So it's also the reason why we add a little bit of acid, usually vinegar, to the water when we're boiling bones. That helps demineralize the bones. So it helps the minerals that are in the bones, basically it helps them break apart so that they can go into the liquid. It's also why we tend to boil our bones for so long. I typically do a 48-hour broth. I think, Stacey, you do the same, right?
It depends. If it's stovetop, it's 48. If it's
slow cooker,
it's twice as long. If it's pressure cooker, well, no. If it's slow cooker, it's 48. If it's stovetop, it's 24. And if it's pressure cooker, it's 12 for us.
I do the same ratios, but longer. So if it's stovetop, it's 48 hours. If it's slow cooker, it's 5 days. If it's pressure cooker, it's usually 12 hours.
And it also depends on what kind of bones you're using. If you're using smaller, thinner bones, then obviously you're going to cook through them faster. So if you're using, like for us, we use, often we use trotters or chicken feet. We're able to get what we need out of them faster because of all the little joints and stuff.
So what I look for when I'm cooking broth is I look for the bones to have broken apart to the point where they crumble in my fingers. I mean, they'll still look like a whole bone, but if you pull it out, I can just break it apart with very little effort. And some people will actually eat those bones. You can throw it in a smoothie, although I would only recommend doing that if you have a really high power blender, because it can be a little bit gritty if you're not blending it in something like a Vitamix or BlendTec. A lot of people will mix it into pet food. I know my mom feeds the bones left over from making bone broth to her very, very, very old dog. And it's amazing the difference in him when he's eating the bones. Like, suddenly he can walk. It'll last a few hours. But, like, it's really, really...
You basically just described me as an old dog.
So when you eat bones, you suddenly can walk for a few hours?
When I eat very concentrated bone broth and soup, I definitely can walk much easier. Due to the aforementioned knee pain from chronic inflammation from being obese for so long.
See, it's all relevant. So that's why we love broth. And that's also kind of how we make it. I think we just already shared our magic recipes, didn't we?
Yeah, I think we each have recipes in our cookbooks. Both Eat Like a Dinosaur and Beyond Bacon have recipes. We have a different recipe for pork stock than we use other bones for, because pork has like a film that comes to the top that we don't usually find in other bones. So we have a recommendation on that that's pretty unique. And we also recommend adding a little bit of apple cider vinegar to help the bones break down. And we also add vegetables, but towards the end. We don't make our stock with vegetables. Like a lot of people, when you're only cooking soup for a couple of hours, which is what most people do with the bones, they tell you to put the veggies in kind of right away with the bones, and then you're done in 3 hours. But because we cook our soup for so much longer, well, we cook our stock or broth or whatever you're going to call it, we recommend adding the veggies later. Just because
I do the same. So I usually add the aromatic vegetables for the last 3 to 4 hours.
Yeah.
It's because when you cook vegetables that long, the chemical reactions, I don't actually know what compounds are being produced, but it gets quite bitter. So it's not a good flavor when the vegetables are cooked that long, but adding them towards the end, and it's a much nicer flavor in the end.
Yeah, so that's what I got on that.
All right, let's do some questions.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Ingrid from Reading, Pennsylvania. I think it's Reading, right? It's not Reading. Reading?
I believe it's, yeah.
All right. I apologize if I just mispronounced the entire town's name. Or city. It could be a city, and then it's even more people. Ugh, this whole places name things is like the biggest challenge of this podcast. All right, Ingrid writes, okay, so which bone broth is the most nutrient-dense broth? Chicken from a good source like Polyface Incorporated bone broth, grass-finished beef bone broth, wild-caught fish broth. The reason that I ask is that I'm learning through the paleosphere that chicken may not necessarily be a nutrient-dense food. What about the chicken bone broth? Is one bone broth more healing to the intestinal lining than another? Thanks. I love your podcast, websites, books, and tweets that you share. Thanks.
Well, I'm curious to see what you say. But what I have personally found as the biggest contributor is that things with joints have the most collagen in them. So I can't speak to nutrient density as it relates to the other micronutrients that Sarah talked about. But in terms of collagen, there is definitely... So the thing with collagen that we haven't really talked about is you know you have a good broth when your lips are sticky when you drink or eat soup. So for me, when I have the soup that Matt makes me, it literally is like it makes my lips stick together as I have the soup. And when the soup is cold, it congeals together and looks kind of like jello. So that's how you know that you've got a very collagen-rich broth. And the way that we successfully get a collagen-rich broth is by adding at least some form of bone to the soup that has a lot of collagen. Our personal recommendations are feet because they're very cheap and they have a lot of joints that have collagens. You can also use necks, you can use oxtail, you can use a knuckle. Anything that's like a joint or has a lot of joints is going to be an easy way to get a lot of collagen. Sarah, do you have a breakdown of which animals? I mean, I would assume what we haven't mentioned is fish stock. I don't make a lot of fish stock, and I feel like we should do more of that because I'm assuming that that's going to have added omega-3s.
Yeah. Fish bones actually have a higher collagen to mineral ratio than land animal bones, so you actually very, very easily get a lot more collagen in your stock from fish bones if you're doing like fish heads or fish, you know, if you're just saving the skeletons from doing cooking whole fish or filleting whole fish and you put all the skeletons in your freezer. The real difference between them, I mean, especially if you're like Stacey just said, you know, making the decision, that's not the right word, going to the effort to get some connective tissue rich bones, so anything with joints like feet, to add to your stock. The big difference is going to be in how healthy the fats are in the fat layer on the top. So the reason why chicken is sort of not the best choice in terms of proteins is because even fully pasteurized chicken is naturally higher in omega-6. So the best, you know, optimal diet of that chicken, the best sort of omega-6 to 3 ratio that you can get is about 7 times omega-6s compared to omega-3s. And ideally, we'd like to stay somewhere between 1 to 1 to 3 or maybe 4 to 1 omega-6s to 3s. And so chicken doesn't help that very much. You know, beef, grass-fed beef is already at that level. Fish is crazy with omega-3s. Even the highest omega-6 content farmed white fish will have like a 2-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3s. So it's still actually a really, really healthy ratio for us to be consuming. So that's why, you know, we sort of recommend, you know, don't go nuts on nuts, pardon the pun, and limit chicken. Chicken has a lot of great other nutrients, but if you're eating a lot of nuts or you're eating a lot of conventional meat, it can contribute a lot of omega-6s to the diet. And if you're eating conventional chicken, it can be as bad as 45 times as much omega-6 as omega-3, depending on, you know, exactly the feed of that chicken and what breed of chicken it is. So you know, the main argument against chicken is the omega-6 polyunsaturated fat content. So if you're making broth from the chicken, all that really means is that you want to skim the fat off your broth. And you're still getting all of that other great stuff out of the bones. You're still getting the minerals. You're still getting the collagen. And, you know, I personally really like the flavor of chicken broth. I know Stacey's anti-chicken broth flavor. But I think it's yummy.
It's like, okay, so here's the thing. It's like anything else, right? Like you have Coke, you drink Coca-Cola for a really long time and then you switch to Diet Coke and you're going to be like, ooh, Diet Coke's really gross because that's what you had. Even though like some people think that Diet Coke's the best thing ever. I don't drink either of those. I don't know why I just made this analogy, but I think
anti-paleo analogy.
Well, that's, I think almost everybody can, like, you either like diet or you like regular. So I have soup every single morning for breakfast, and I most often have soup with the bones left over from the whole animals that we buy, which are pork and cow and venison. And so when I have something that's so very different, like chicken, it's like switching to Diet Coke. And I'm like, what is this? Why does it taste wrong? So there's nothing, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with chicken. I don't want people to get the impression, because they were kind of anti-chicken on the show. Like, I eat chicken. And
speak for yourself. I am not anti-chicken.
I think we come across as anti-chicken. So
I think people need to be careful with how much chicken they're eating if they're not eating seafood.
So that's the thing is, if you prefer chicken stock, and I know that there are a lot of people who do, or let's say you buy whole chickens and you want to make stock out of the bones, don't take what we're saying as, oh, well, this stock isn't going to be good for me, so I'm just going to throw the bones away. Do not do that. Like, what we do
Don't throw the bones away,
because I will come to your house with my paleo police badge and I will tell you that you're doing it wrong. No, what I recommend that you do, or at least what we do, is Matt saves those chicken bones until he also has something else that can balance it out. In most cases, that's beef bones. So normally we make a pure pork stock and then we make a chicken/beef stock, and that works well for us. So, you know, if you want to try to have a better, omega-6, omega-3 ratio, or if you're trying to get a more developed flavor, let's say, you will get a more rich broth when you mix bones as well, because it's going to be a multi-dimensional flavor. So by all means, do not get rid of those bones. Don't think that we're saying not to eat it. We're just saying, you know, conventional wisdom tells you that chicken is the protein that everyone should be eating. And yes, it's higher in protein, like gram to gram, than, you know, pork or whatever. And therefore, and it's leaner, and it's all these things that, you know, conventional wisdom tells you is great. We know that lean meat is not the best thing. And we know that fat is not a bad thing. We know that omega-3s are great because our doctors are telling us to take it in pills. So what we're trying to encourage you to do is, rather than taking a fish oil supplement, is just to eat more fish or eat more foods that's higher in omega-3 so that you don't need to augment it with a fish oil supplement. Because if you're eating grass-fed beef on a regular basis as your main protein, then you're getting naturally more omega-3s without needing to take a supplement to do so. That's our point. So we're not... chickens are cute. They're fine.
They lay eggs. We like eggs. Like,
I love chicken. We eat chicken, but we eat it in, as part of, you know, a diet that also includes a lot of other meats and a lot of seafood. This is our very, very, very long-winded way of saying they're all good. They're all good. Should we move on to question two?
Maybe we've answered a whole bunch of questions in our one question tangent. We've forgotten how to answer questions.
Oh, it's been, it has been a while. All right. This question is from, I hope the name is Nicole from Bristol, Florida. Nicole, if your name is not pronounced Nicole, I apologize. The second hardest thing about this show is pronouncing people's names.
That's why I have you do it.
Right. Ah, the dirty jobs. I recently found your podcast and just love it. I started from the beginning and I'm currently on number 11. Even though I have an iPhone, I don't use iTunes, so I'm still trying to figure out how to leave a review. Thanks for taking time to share your knowledge. So in the background, she mentioned that she's pregnant and she made bone broth and that it smelled terrible. So her first question is, should bone broth smell bad while cooking? Her second question is, have you ever purchased bone broth online in a way of getting around cooking it and smell? And would you recommend buying bone broth online? You want to tackle that?
First of all, I want to apologize for not realizing that I was muting while I was eating my dinner. I'm sorry about that, everybody.
I'm hungry.
There's always something that I do that's inappropriate every week. What would our podcast be without me post-WOD eating? Okay, so when we first made bone broth in the house, I remember saying to Matthew that something was wrong. it's become an intoxicating smell for me at this point. When I wake up in the morning after he's put on a pot of broth in the evening and I can smell it simmering, I literally wake up like starving because I've smelled it all night long while I've been sleeping and my body's like, I want to go to there. That's not necessarily something that happens overnight. And I also find that there are certain bones that are more pungent than others. There are certain animals that are more pungent than others. What I recommended for a good friend that is sensitive to smell is that if you have a grill with a propane burner that you can, or you can plug in your stock outside, maybe you have like a covered porch area, you can do it outside. I also recommend rendering your own lard and tallow that way. Tallow is particularly disgusting smelling to me, just my own personal thoughts on that. Lard's not so bad, but tallow, I can't do tallow in the house. So if you're particularly sensitive, especially when you're pregnant, pregnant women have sensitive smell as it is because your body hormonally enhances your ability to smell so that you're more aware of things that you might be eating that might negatively affect your growing fetus. So when you're pregnant, you're often just disgusted by the smell of everything, including, you know, a friend's perfume or whatever. So especially if you are sensitive to smells, doing it outside, either in a crock pot or on a our grill has a propane burner type thing that sometimes we make sauces on and stuff. You could do a stock out there if you wanted. It would probably be an expensive stock because you're using a lot of propane, but at least then you wouldn't smell it. The question is, have I ever purchased bone broth online? I have not ever personally purchased bone broth online. I do know that there's a couple of vendors that are legitimate that you can purchase bone broth online. I know that U.S. Wellness Meats at least sometimes has stock. I believe that Tropical Tradition sometimes sells stock. There is a new company called like the Bone Broth Company or something like that.
That's what it's something like the Broth Company or the Broth. Yeah, the Broth.
Actually contacted me and asked me if I want some of their broth. And I told them, like, I am so particular about broth that I would not be a good person to test because I am so picky and Matt makes the best broth in the whole wide world and
Matt,
I have it every
good broth.
And I have it every single day. So I'm like, I don't want anybody else's broth, but, I would definitely trust those sources. I don't know if there's other sources out there. I would not... okay, let me clarify. I have purchased... I think there's like a brand at Whole Foods called Pacific or something that has not a lot of junk or fillers in it. I wouldn't drink that stock with the mindset of this is nutrient dense and nourishing my body. However, in a pinch, if you're trying to make a recipe and it calls for a cup of stock and you don't have any in the freezer or on hand, certainly doing something clean ingredient like that from a store shelf would be helpful. But when we talk about bone broth for health, we're talking about like someone has homemade with real broth in a very concentrated, nutrient dense, healthiest animals possible sort of way. That's what's giving you the health punch. So from that capacity, I would trust those three vendors that I mentioned or make it myself. Or farms. I mean, I found it a lot at farms too, because often farmers can't get rid of their bones. And so they make their own stock because it's something they can freeze and sell more readily than the bones. And butchers. I'm sorry. I'm saying another one. But all of my butchers in the local area sell broth as well.
Are you done?
Maybe not. You never know.
It's like, I have nothing to add.
It's my show, man. I haven't been this excited since we did breastfeeding. I'm like, yeah, this is my jam. I've got information on this.
All right. Well, then I'll just read the next question. You can go nuts. It's from Janice from West Palm Beach, Florida, who writes in all caps, love your podcasts.
Which, by the way, you'll notice that all the women who are getting their questions read today are complimenting us. So good job, ladies.
That may or may not have factored into my decision when I picked the questions. And she writes, I feel like we're sitting around a table enjoying a nice cup of tea. Keep up the great work.
She's obviously Canadian.
From Florida. There's a lot of Canadians in Florida.
Not a lot of Americans sit around a table enjoying a nice cup of tea.
That does sound like a very Canadian thing, doesn't it? Well, I love tea, and I love sitting around a table enjoying a nice cup of tea. So, Janice, you and I are on the same page. Janice wrote, I've tried making bone broth numerous times. After it's cooked for 12 hours, I will put it in containers and put it in the fridge. I will skim off the hard grease and then use the rest for soup. But it's still too greasy for my system. I believe Janice has no gallbladder. What do I need to do to change my recipe? Stacey, this is totally your shtick.
Eat some carbs with it. I don't have a better answer for her. If she's skimming off the grease that rises to the top, there's nothing more you can do to that broth to make it less greasy. Pork is going to be your fattiest broth, so fish or chicken would be the most ideal broth. Maybe try those out. But what I do to successfully have broth is I make it very vegetable. You can see the soups that I have every day. I have a recipe on the blog for Stacey's soup that Matt details how he makes my soup every day. I don't just drink plain broth. That doesn't go well in my system. What I do is chock it full of vegetables to give me some fiber and carbohydrate to aid in the digestion. I also take ox bile. Because especially if you're having it for the first meal in the morning, people without a gallbladder in a fasted state have a difficult time digesting anything that you're eating for the first time. So often my first meal of the day is my most difficult to digest because my system hasn't built up that bile storage that a gallbladder would provide in the morning. So I definitely have to take ox bile for my first meal of the day, to aid in that digestion and make sure that I'm eating carbohydrate.
All right, I'm going to read the next question because I nailed that.
Woohoo!
It's from Kayla from Plainwell, Michigan. I'm having a really hard time with me.
You're
today.
Rocking it so hard.
I just apologize to everyone for butchering their names and the names of their places where they live, and hopefully I'm at least reading their questions somewhat accurately. All right, so Kayla writes, my question is on the safety and quality of wild, deer and elk mostly, organ meats and bones. I've been doing some Googling and it's pretty much all over the place. Is it safe to eat organ meats like liver, heart, kidneys, and of course the bones for bone broth? And I do realize that with the recent diseases that have been plaguing deer, there was an outbreak here in Michigan last year, that you run a risk no matter what part of the deer you eat. So safety aside, am I doing myself a disservice in choosing wild meat over beef?
Okay, wait. I thought there were like several questions in there.
Okay, so basically, she's got this great source of wild meat, and she wants to know if it's safe to use the bones for bone broth, and then we can also sort of address the safety of organ meat, or at least refer her to the podcast where we discussed safety of organ meat from wild and grass-fed meat versus conventional. But basically, she wants to know if bone broth from wild animals is good.
Well, I'm down. I make broth with my dad gets several deer for us a year. He is a hunter, and I feel that there's no better way to respect the animal and the earth than for him to respectfully take the life. And people may disagree, but I was a vegetarian for 7 years, and I know that Tyson chicken is not respecting their meat the way that my father does when he hunts. So he also got us a turkey last year, which is interesting. We had no idea how to properly take care of it, because a deer we take to a butcher and they do all the work for us, but a turkey we were like, oh, we can do it ourselves, and Google let us down. So anyway, that's a tangent. What I can say is that I personally eat it, and I think that it is assumed by my own standards to be more nutrient rich, because that animal was ideally eating their literal wild diet. They are eating what they are intended to eat because they are in the wild. So where we encourage grass-fed and free-range animals, the reason that we're encouraging that is because that's the natural diet to the animal. And when the animal is eating their natural diet, they are the healthiest they can be, which means they're giving you the most nutrients that you can have when you consume them. So with that mindset, when my dad brings us venison, I certainly use any and all parts that he brings. He, however, does not bring me all of the parts, because he's squeamish and gets rid of the organ meats and leaves it there for coyotes, which I think is really fascinating and part of his like respectful giving back to the earth kind of thing that he does, because he doesn't want it to go to waste. So anyway, that's, I just don't know why I gave you all that information about my dad being a hunter, but it's pretty graphic. The answer to your question is I certainly do. I also did a lot of research for Beyond Bacon on wild animal diseases, and that is a genuine concern. It's like the only people that still have trichinosis are wild animals. So I would just highly encourage you, when you're talking about eating wild animal organ meats, to make sure that they're fully cooked through. I would not eat pink liver from a wild caught anything, because it is possible that it could be more likely to have disease than those who are carefully controlled in a safe environment like a farm.
You just said everything I was going to say.
I'm sorry. I said way more than I should have said, however.
Yeah. I mean, basically, I think it's very, very easy to argue that just like the meat from wild game is healthier than the meat from farmed animals, or at least equal to. I mean, that's the whole reason for doing grass-fed, is to be sort of comparable to wild game. Same goes for organ meat. Same goes for the bones for bone broth. The only thing that you have to be careful about beyond zoonotic diseases is some organ meat from some animals. I know bear for sure. So I think it tends to be some more of the omnivores that have a large amount of protein in their diets, that for example, bear liver is so high in vitamin A that it can be toxic for humans. So I don't I actually should probably fact check that. That's what I've always been told, and it may or may not be true. I don't actually know, but I've been told that, and I think that's definitely something to look up. It's definitely fine from herbivores like deer and elk, but if you're going to be getting into the omnivores, that's just something I would double check before diving into your well-cooked liver. All right, I think this is the last question. I think it is. Ooh.
Okay. Wow, that we made good time.
Well, let's see what we can do with this last question. It's from Gail from London, England. Hey, ladies. So I think this is a Science with Sarah question. Please geek out in true Science with Sarah style. I put it in questions and answers, though, instead of science. So, sorry, Gail. I'll still geek out, though. I just got a whole load of marrow bones from my butcher to make a fresh batch of broth, of course, and I was putting them in the stock pot. I noticed they were extra marrowy. So while the broth was simmering, I fished out each 9-inch bone from the broth and sucked out all of the marrow. I'm
this
salivating.
Lady is so our bestie.
I know, and I'm literally, like, reading this. I am, like, going to have a hard time reading the rest because I'm salivating at the thought. There was a lot of marrow, and I feel a wee bit sick, but it was completely delicious.
Sorry. I don't mean to laugh at you, Gail. I'm laughing with you.
And the oil that came out of the bones with it tasted exactly like butter. Well, I should say it tasted exactly like how I remember butter to taste. I harvested this oil, and it has set up as a beautiful pale yellow, opaque and waxy fat, quite butter-like. I'm planning on using it in place of butter for special. Amazing for a girl devoid of dairy. I love my coconut oil and home-rendered lard and tallow and bacon grease, but sometimes the taste of butter, only the taste of butter will do. Incidentally, I use mostly macadamia nut oil on those occasions. So my questions, is this fat fat, or is it a mix of other things, and do you reckon it'll keep well? What sort of goodness will it contain, and please say there's no badness.
That is, this lady Gail, we hurt you. That is a reference to one of our favorite podcasts with Nom Nom Paleo, by the way, for listeners who haven't listened to that fantastic show.
Badness being my favorite word ever since. Is this different to the goodness in the unmelted marrow? What is the nutritional profile of the actual marrow? Is it good for us and why? This is a lot of questions. And last but not least, why does it taste and even look like butter? I'm sure there's got to be some sciencey reasons. A big thank you to you two lovely ladies. I love listening to you girls. I'm another gal who lost 100 pounds and have been AIP paleo for a few years and still finding my way. Currently working my way through newly diagnosed hypothyroidism and estrogen dominance. Huzzah for bioidentical hormones. By the way, I just love this. I have a great recipe for a nightshade dairy-free creamy curry. Show me if you would like it. Yes, Gail. A big paleo love from Gail with a little X for kiss.
Gail, I would like you to email me and I'm going to send you a copy of our book just because I like you so much. You probably already have a copy, but that's fine. You need to have a copy. You can pick either book. Email me. I got nothing. I got no idea. I mean, it's delicious. That's marrow. People make like spreads and all kinds of delicious things with marrow because it's just delicious. But I don't know why it tastes and look like butter for a scientific reason. I'm going to let you take this one, geek lady.
Woohoo. All right. I get to answer a question. So marrow has all kinds of amazing stuff in it. So it, the marrow in our bones is basically full of stem cells, and they're stem cells that make all different kinds of blood cells. So they make red blood cells, and they make white blood cells, and they make B cells and T cells. So those are two really, really key, or the two key types of cells in the adaptive immune system. So the part of the immune system that actually is specific and recognizes specific foreign invaders. So the reason why, you know, vaccines mean you never get polio is all thanks to B cells and T cells. And so the bone marrow is incredibly important for us because if we didn't have bone marrow, we wouldn't have blood cells. And it's why, for example, you have bone marrow transplants after radiation therapy that wipes out the bone marrow, is because you need to have stem cells in your bone marrow to make blood, white blood cells so that you have an immune system. So what's in the marrow is all of these stem cells, and then there's a whole community of support cells to support the activities of those stem cells, including actually a fairly large amount of adipocytes, or fat storage cells, and they're specifically storing some of the healthiest fat in the entire body as energy and also as ingredients for these stem cells, because all membranes and cells are made up of fats. So bone marrow is naturally very fatty because of the adipocytes in it. It's also very naturally rich in the very different amino acids than what you would find in muscle meat, because it's the amino acids that are in blood cells. So it's actually, in that sense, a lot more similar to, say, collagen, a lot more similar to, say, milk. And it's a very different amino acid profile. And it's one of the, you know, incredibly, it's one of the healthiest things that you can eat. I mean, again, it's awful. And it's incredibly nutrient dense, and it's nutrient dense because it has this really, really fundamental role in the body. So it is full of goodness. There is no badness that I am aware of. And the fat, so there's the marrow itself is fatty, which is one of the reasons why it tastes like pure bliss. I believe that would be the best description for the taste of marrow. And if the fat is a rendering out and rising to the top of your broth, if it's lifting up to the top of your broth, that is the fat. If you're eating it from the marrow, it's fat mixed with protein. And so it's generally, especially if it's good quality bones, it's going to be a very, very good fat profile. Although I will say that why it tastes like butter is probably due to certain types of fats that are similar between marrow and butter. Also probably some things like conjugated linoleic acid. And, you know, flavors is complex. So it may also have to do with the fact that a lot of the amino acid profile in marrow has some similarities to the amino acid profile in milk, although I don't know that for sure. But, you know, there's some definitely some similar nutrition between marrow and high quality butter, and that would be why there's a similarity in flavor. When I have marrow, I don't typically think of it as buttery, but I always eat the marrow before it dissolves into the broth and makes that layer of fat. So I'd have to taste that and do my own taste test comparison. Do you think it tastes like butter?
I don't. I think because we have ghee, maybe we should tell this lady that she could maybe
get
check out ghee. She's on AIP, so maybe she can't do it. But
she might want to try cultured grass-fed ghee. So my 4-year-old is ridiculously allergic, or sensitive, it's not actually a true allergy, to casein. And it's so bad that if we were to cut cheese on a cutting board, rinse the cutting board off with a cloth and some water, and then cut an apple in the cutting board, she would have a reaction. So we actually have to like sterilize the cutting board in between, which is why we don't have very much dairy in our house. And she can actually handle cultured grass-fed ghee. So I know pure Indian foods, I don't know if they're available in the UK, but they do a cultured grass-fed ghee that my daughter's fine with.
They're on Amazon, so they might be on Amazon UK.
Maybe. But that's what I would look for, because the culturing step degrades the protein before the clarification. So whatever 0.03% of ghee that's actually trace protein, that protein's already degraded. And so it's usually fine for people with dairy allergies. It's at least worth trying carefully. If she's, you know, goes into anaphylactic shock when she has dairy, I would try it with an EpiPen close by. But, you know, my my 4-year-old is very much the canary in the coal mine when it comes to casein, and she does really, really well with it.
Cool. So my point was with that because I have butter and ghee and cream in my diet, marrow tastes
like
buttery, yeah. Yes, but not like butter, if that makes sense. Like it's its own fat flavor for me. It's not
butter. Blissful, wonderful, heavenly.
No, it's definitely blissful. It's just, you know, it tastes like the animal that it came from in most cases. So, and it can be, especially for those people without a gallbladder. I can't just eat like she, like, so, ladled this marrow into her mouth from the soup, which is awesome. I can't do that because it is very fatty. What we do is actually mix it into the soups and stews that I eat. It's particularly wonderful in pot roast, so like it kind of adds a creamy, velvety texture to that.
See, I may or may not have figured out that if you take a straw, it's a really great way of sucking the marrow out of long bones that you can't.
I hope you appreciate your gallbladder every day.
I do. I love my gallbladder. I'm very fond of it. Just a trick for everybody out there. Straws are excellent marrow eating tools.
All right. Well, that's a wrap. We did an actual show, and we hope you enjoyed it. Thank you again to everyone for your support and patience. We hope that you now understand why I am the broth lady. Sarah didn't get into it because she's done a Science with Sarah before, but I have a particular genetic autoimmune condition that makes me particularly sensitive in the gut, and soup from bones helps me repair in a way that is even more beneficial for most people from our estimation. So that is why I am obsessed. We have both a lot of recipes on our websites and our cookbooks, not just for the broth itself, but utilizing the broth. I want to encourage everyone to think about broth outside the confines of drinking it in a mug. You can choose to be a crazy cave person if you'd like, but you don't need to be. You can use broth to make sauces, to make soups. We add it to almost everything that we make. So if you're looking for ideas to get more broth in, our book, Beyond Bacon, uses broth in a ton of recipes, and so does Real Life Paleo, which is coming out in November, so that doesn't really help you, but we've also got a lot on the blog, and I know Sarah's got tons of a fall and broth recipes on her site, and her book will be out before my book, which will have broth recipes in it as well. So really genuinely try to see if you can get this in a few times a week. And like Sarah's mom's dog and me, it literally makes us feel better and able to walk more easily. So I have confidence that it will make you feel better as well.
Sweet. That's a show.
We'll be back next week, everyone.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Can you hear me now?
It's better. It's just Canada.
Well, I am a very, very, very long way away from.
We have this many questions on broth. Oh my gosh.
That is why I thought it was an excellent topic for a show.